What's up, everyone? I'm Ruthina Porterfield, and this is Liberated Conversations with Ruthina. The excerpt for today's episode is from a blog post on my website, ruthinaporterfield.com, and it begins with honoring the lives of nine people by saying their names. Reverend Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Cynthia Graham Hurd, Susie J. Jackson, Ethel Lee Lance, Reverend DePayne Vontrese Middleton, Reverend Clemente C. Pinckney, Tywanza Sanders, Reverend Daniel Lee Simmons Sr., and Myra Singleton Quarles Thompson. The conversation in this episode is one I hold in the highest esteem of all of those I've had since starting my podcast back in August. I'm speaking with Jamila Gadsden. She is a fellow Charleston native, a fellow Buist Academy alum, and she is also someone who lost her aunt, Myra Thompson, in the shooting at Mother Emanuel AME Church. It is a shooting that was fueled by racism and hate that took the lives of nine people on June 17th, 2015. But today, we are going to talk about the legacy of those nine people and how on the 17th of this month and every other month, you can be a part of that legacy. So join the conversation. Liberated Conversations with Ruthina is sponsored by the Andrea Chanel Signature Hair Care Collection. For all of your healthy hair care needs, go to AndreaChanelHair.com.
Hello, Jamila. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I think we are so much better with take two.
Yes, we are. And oh, I am so good to see you and to be able to talk with you.
Likewise. I want to jump right in, if that's okay with you.
That's perfect.
And I kind of want to start at the beginning because I think we have had the privilege of growing up in the Deep South. Mm-hmm. We are a part of a generation that is directly behind the generation of the Civil Rights Movement. We have parents that lived it, right?
Yep.
But I think we also are privileged in that we are the generation immediately prior to this technology age, where they are capturing things that we never saw or fathom was happening around the country. Right. Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. We're like bridging the gap.
Right.
I feel like, you know, my mom lives here with me and my son. And I always
like
bridging the gap. He thinks I'm ancient, and you know, she feels like, okay, this new world, what's going on? So you're like bridging the back gap, reaching back and looking forward, reaching
you
back.
You are a house that is representative of what's going on for real.
Yes.
Yeah. I think part of that was going to Buist Academy. You had, I'm so grateful that you had a chance to listen to the conversation that I had with another one of our classmates, Jameson. Yes. As well as the conversation with the first principal of the first magnet school that ever was established in Charleston, which I had no idea that we were kind of making history there.
Oh, yeah, we were. It was, I remember when we graduated from Buist, we were the last.
We were the last of the first.
And it was, it was a scary time. I even remember like the first person I met when I went to Buist. And it was like, ooh, I've never been to school with white people.
Which is exactly what I want to get into because
it was a different thing. And I felt like even they were like, okay, well, I've never been to school with you either. So and I always have shared with my mom and a few other people how the hesitation and any angst never came from the students, the other kids. It was always with the grown-ups. So I feel like
absolutely right.
Being that group of students who started Buist Academy in their inaugural year.
Yeah.
We were that group that even, you know, we talk about, I mentioned being the bridge, but we taught those adults how important it was to know us and to understand who we are and to understand our culture, even though we all were right here in Charleston, there were unique differences. So we were all learning each other and learning how to appreciate each other, how to grow with each other, because we truly grew up with a core set of people from third grade through eighth grade at Buist Academy. We grew up together.
We really
Another reason my experience there was so unique and really meant a lot to me, my mom and her sisters went to Buist when they were in elementary school.
What?
Before the school closed and then reopened as Buist Academy. My mom went there. So I think my grandparents went there. And so it was like a generational thing. I felt like this is where I belong. You know, my church was right across the street. And so
I remember that
neighborhood, you know, was my home. But when I went inside the building, there were times where I felt a little unfamiliar.
Me too.
You know, or like, you know, we have to navigate a new situation, or you have a new teacher who doesn't really know all about us. And, you know, we have to, you know, teach them that, yes, we are here and we're smart.
And we are smart.
Just as the next.
Yes.
And, you know, we can do this. We have something to offer.
We do. So, and it was a huge it was a huge transition. It was the first, like I said in previous podcasts, which I definitely encourage everyone to go back and check out. They are on my website. This was the first time I had been to a white person's house before. This was the first time. It wasn't even just about being surrounded in school. Yeah. But this was the first time going to homes that did not look like mine. I wanted to ask you if you had this experience that I had, like I talked about on, I think with the conversation with Jameson, where I went to white birthday parties, but they never came to mind. Did you have that same?
I did. So I remember, there are a couple of things that like stick out to me so much is that one, where she lived in downtown Charleston, we didn't venture, that across Calhoun, that ooh, side.
Yes, I remember, like, girl.
So I was like, oh, wow, I get to go to, like, I get to this house. Like, it was and so she... just an amazing, amazing friend that we had the privilege of growing up with. Never, I mean, I think just because children are, and this is why I know racism, hatred, all that stuff, it's learned. Because that was never a thing for us. And I feel like I remember talking to my parents and saying, she's just my friend. Because that's all it was. She's just my friend.
Wow.
And I think when, again, we had to be that bridge, even with, you know, I think now of the struggle that our parents who grew up during the civil rights era had to deal with, knowing that we were going to eventually have these kinds of experiences, and how would they handle that? they're some of the ones that I am grateful that I was able to have, and that my parents allowed me to have, because that was a key thing for your parents to allow you to have those kinds of experiences. I'm grateful and feel blessed that I was able to.
Yeah, because this stuff has an impact on children. Yeah. I think even the children, and you're a mom, you know, your son is going to remember this stuff. Everything that's happening, he's going to remember. I remember the details of walking to Francis Marion Park, which I want to kind of use as a segue because, you know, I was kind of clueless on exactly, I didn't know who Francis Marion was. You know, we just kind of walked to the park because that's where we had PE sometimes. We had field day there sometimes. There was a statue there. We had no clue. And it was not taught. We grew up in a time where Black history in school was limited to Martin Luther King. Slavery happened. Civil War ended it. Martin Luther King came along, and now we can sit at the front of the bus. Like, that's
great. And we all love each other.
It's just one big happy country. Like, that's what we grew up in.
But and you knew, you had that feeling that this is not there's something, there's a little something. And I think that was trying to navigate, especially as an 8-year-old. Like, we were eight when we were 8, 9, 10, to navigate that feeling. Even if it wasn't verbalized, to navigate how people made you feel. And I think we always have to be cognizant of how our actions, even facial expressions, mannerisms, everything can inform someone else of who you are and what your inner thoughts are and what you believe. And so we always have to be cognizant of that, and just know that no matter what it is, it enacts a feeling in an emotion for someone else. And
I think, you know, not being taught that stuff in school and kind of having to learn on your own, that type of stuff. As far as like growing up in Charleston and the racial stuff that was, we grew up in a time where there were no cell phones, there were no, you know, tablets and stuff.
Right.
So stuff that was happening around us, we were kind of unaware of, but there was still stuff going on. Like, I remember, roll with me. I remember, okay, we all remember where we were when the Challenger exploded, right?
It was post-class.
I was sick that day. I remember I was sick that day and I was home. But here's what I remember. I remember them talking about the astronauts that were on the spaceship, on the Challenger. Mm-hmm. But I remember Ronald E. McNair. That's what I remember. And I remember that because he was the only Black person on the Challenger. So things like that stick with us, right? And then I remember them renaming the school. We didn't, because there were no cameras, we didn't see the other stuff that was happening to Black people in the midst of this. Now, I will say this, Jamila. We knew who Strom Thurmond was. Yeah. And we knew, and this is a guy who represented South Carolina. And this is huge for us to talk about now, because we're coming up on an election in literally, what, 2-3 weeks?
Yeah.
We knew who Strom Thurmond was and how he was the senator. He was in the place where Lindsey Graham is, where we're trying to vote him out. Or where you guys, I wish I was in South Carolina to help vote that I could help
we vote him out.
Every vote counts, people. But Strom Thurmond was in that seat when we were growing up. And we were very clear that this was a racist that was in that office. We were very clear. And I think, and the reason why I'm going through this is because I want people to understand the environment that led up to June 17, 2015. I think people want to isolate that date. Especially nationally.
Or even that person to think that, oh, this is a one-off. To even think about how could we, how in 2015, how could it come to that? And it was, it's for me and many of us, it's like, oh, we can give you the backstory. We can go back and share and let you know that we are not very far removed from, you know, civil rights era, or when, you know, when things were, when tensions were extremely high, and, you know, those, you could like cut it with a knife. Like, we're not that very far removed from it. And I think, especially our, like, a kind of back and forth, I think that sometimes we tend to go through, because we've seen the progress. We've been a part of the progress and probably have influenced a lot of the progress, because we were thrust into it without, you know, really having any say-so. So we had to adapt and adjust, but we still had to understand where that came from. One of the other memories I do have from our time at Buist, and why I mentioned about the church being right across the street. So every day, depending on whose classroom I was in, I could look out the window and see my church. And
Jamila, I'm going to cut you because I want you to be very clear what church.
Oh, okay. That was across the street. Yes.
Very clear.
Emmanuel, AME Church.
Right.
Was right across the street from Buist Academy. So,
right.
And I don't know if you remember this, but when we were in fourth grade, we did a field trip there. And it was from I think we used to do like a morning announcements, and somebody got to speak in the morning. And one morning I shared how my family grew up, like my mom and grandparents went to Buist before it was Buist Academy, and that my church, Mother Emmanuel, across the street was a part of the Underground Railroad.
That's right.
Our teacher at the time, Mr. Reardon, was like, that is so awesome. I think we should go visit. Could we go visit there? And I remember going and asking my pastor, and I remember him saying, but you're going to have to teach them about the church. I remember that. And I remember other, like, our classmates saying, wow, I didn't know that all of that happened right here.
Yeah.
Like, we were steps away from things that you should have been reading about in the history book.
Yes.
Just steps away from it. And just the impact. So, you know, it is very, like, for me, when I talk about Mother Emmanuel and talk about the experiences that I had growing up, it's more than just the place I went to on Sunday morning, or, you know, the school I went to for a couple of years. Like, it really did shape who I am. And all of it was intertwined, and all of it has played a part in who I am now and who I continue to be, and how I teach my child. Like,
you're getting a comment from another parent saying a good job for force that history on your son, because it's important. It's important for him to know that this is stuff that they need to grasp and they need to know. And the reality is, they may not get it now. It's so important. They may not get it now, but they'll get it later. Like, they'll get it. So when we talk about the climate, so I want to move a little closer to June 17th. And one of the things which was so cool when we talked in our pre-interview, when you mentioned Donald Trump announcing his candidacy after. But what I actually remembered is that only 2 months prior was when Walter Scott was shot and killed as he was running away. And so he was shot and killed in his back as he was running away from the police in North Charleston. Yes. So I think, again, this all contributes to the climate. June 17, 2015 is not an isolated date. Mm-hmm. This stuff was going on for a long time. And so we saw what happened with Walter Scott literally only 2 months prior. Mm-hmm. And then June 17th hits. And we have this young man who comes in and does right. that. And I'm like, you know, it's weird when you see your hometown. I wrote a blog about it. It's very weird when your hometown becomes a headline, especially when you live in a small
right.
kind of place that no one ever really talks about. So I guess my question is, in the aftermath of June 17th, and let me ask this question so we can clear it for everyone who's listening, because I want to get those questions of people who have just those quick, simple questions. Where were you when you got the news about June 17th, about the shooting?
Okay. So I was actually traveling. I traveled quite a bit for work, mm-hmm. and I was coming back from Georgia. And
oh wow.
Stopped at a friend's house and got the call from my godfather, who actually lives across the street from my aunt. And he was calling just to check to see if, you know, if I was at church, or because there was something going on at the church. And yeah, I got a couple calls like back to back with this, where are you? Are you? And I'm like, I'm in Columbia. At that point, I was in Columbia. And I just remember thinking, when I heard, oh, there was a shooting, thinking, oh, it was outside of the church. And maybe yeah. something happened and, you know, what have you. But never in a million years would I have thought that it would have been a shooting inside the church. So,
yeah.
Once I realized that, I immediately said, turn on the news. Like, because I'm like, this got to be on the news. Like, turn on the news. I know I'm in Columbia, yeah, yeah. but turn on CNN. Let me see what's going on.
Right.
And when I saw my church on TV, it was like, oh, my, like it got real. And yeah. I remember sitting there for about a minute or so and hearing that there was apparently a shooting inside the church. And I'm like, my goodness, what in the world? What's happening? Yeah. And it dawned on me, like, if there was a shooting inside my church, then mm-hmm. I know the people who were involved. And I think really? In that moment, yeah, it was I didn't know who was there. I didn't know anything. And I think, like a lot of people, was sitting there waiting to hear something from my past. Of course, this is like in the midst of getting phone calls from different people, just trying, you know, I go to Facebook because I'm like, surely something's going on. And a friend of mine who lived in Columbia, had like posted, Jamila Gadsden, you need to let me know that you're okay. Like, cause I guess she might've tried to call me and couldn't reach me. And so at this point it's like getting to be real. And so I got in contact with my mom, cause I had had a conversation with her earlier, about when I was going to expected to get back home, because she was going with my aunt to the church because my Aunt Myra was going to be teaching Bible study for the first time that night and wanted them to be there. So she was just calling me to see, you know, when I thought I would be in town, because she had my son. So for whatever reason, I was one delay after another getting back. And I remember thinking, like, oh my gosh, like, let me get back in touch with her, because I don't know if she's there.
Oh, that's.
But when I called, God was in the midst of everything. I tell you, even as bad as things were,
right?
He said, we ended up not going. And when I was talking to her, and I said, well, I'm hearing that there was a shooting at the church. She didn't even know what was going on. And then when she did call me back, some other calls transpired, and my aunt told me that that's when she said, well, I know that Myra was still there. And I think that's when I felt like everything in me just dropped, like just hit the floor, like that I know the people who are there, like not just I know their names, but I know them.
And know them.
This is I know them. And my mom has a friend who's on the police force in Mount Pleasant, and she called in a panic, like wanting to know where we were. And she said, well, I don't have all the details, but we're on standby, so it's pretty bad. And I think in those moments, that's when I realized, still thinking, like hoping for the best, like maybe if somebody got hurt, but they would be okay if the police got there in time. But I think it wasn't until my mom called back, and it was the first time I can remember ever hearing her cry, like really cry, and to the point where she was just barely like calling off names, and all I could say to her was stop, like please stop, like she would call out another name, and I'm like, stop, just like we get to the fourth name and I can't take it anymore, like you please stop. So that's
a tough
moment. It was totally unreal. Like I felt like I was in a movie. Like
I'm sure
nothing about it seemed like it was anything that would actually be happening.
Right.
So I kept talking to people, watching the news, like I cannot believe what I'm seeing. And then to later on find out, more about what the cause of this was. And I will say this, when I found out, what happened with my aunt and all the others, there is no, like, it's really, you can't really just separate, oh, I lost my aunt and it was just that one person. Like, you can't separate them. It's nine people that you are accustomed to seeing, hearing from, having conversations with, maybe not all of them on a regular basis, but regular enough to where it has an impact. And in the day or so after, or a few days after, having to have that conversation, my son was four at the time.
Right.
And to have that conversation with him, because, I realized there is no keeping this from him. Like you can shelter children from certain things, but with the way technology and everything else, everybody gets news instantly. There was no, unless we were just going to turn the TV off, there was no keeping him from this. And then we're kind of thrust into, going to court or going to a prayer vigil or going to this or being a part of, having family members come to meet with authorities to hear the details about that. And so it got to a place where I was like, okay, I'm going to have to be mom and sit him down and share this loss. Like,
right.
we haven't experienced anything like this before.
Right.
And so to have to share that with him and answer the questions that even at four, the why, the
yeah.
who would do something like this, or why would they do something like this, or questions about, I remember him asking me one day, like, where were the police? Because, of course, after this happened, we have police all, you know, at the church all the time. And he's like, well, where were they when, you know, the bad man killed Aunt Myra and everybody else? And, like, they came when they could, but, you know, it was too late. And he's like, oh, because they're there now, but why weren't they there when that was happening? And it's like, well, you know, four-year-old, don't ask hard questions, you know?
I know, but it's the childhood logic. It's their logic.
It is. It's their logic, and it makes perfect sense.
It
and
really does.
It's, you know, and those questions, like, we still, to this day, 5 years later, have those kinds of conversations about, well, why did this happen? Or couldn't this have been the case instead of that? And it's like, well, either we can have the conversation, and sometimes I'm just not in a place to where I am in the right headspace to even provide an answer. And I have to say sometimes, I can't, we'll have to discuss that another time.
Because
one of the things that I share with people often is that the grieving process for something like this, and you mentioned Walter Scott, and I now, anytime something of this magnitude happens, when I say my heart goes out to the family, it truly does in a totally different way than it did before, because not only do you grieve the loss of whomever it was, your loved one, your friend, your family member, whomever it was, it's such a public thing that
I was going to ask you about that.
You don't have the space to grieve like you really want to or you should. Like, I feel like you're robbed of the person you lost, and then you're robbed of that too. So I that was some work that I had to do within myself, because it was so public, and I was angry a lot of times, because I just like we went back to church that Sunday after, and I just wanted my church. I just wanted it to be my church family, and we didn't get that. And so I got angry again, and it may have just been the emotion I had in trying to deal with everything, but I felt like we just needed our space. We needed to be together, because for the families, the first time we really saw each other after it happened was going into the courtroom. And so you don't have time and space there. And then everybody is dealing with their own family circumstances.
Right.
The way that they can. So that was what was really difficult and a long process. It's still a process for me now, even 5 years later, just how, like, grieving the way that you know people need to when they suffer a loss.
Especially like that,
Yeah.
I know. I'm glad you touched on the dynamic of having to grieve, have this private experience in a public space. One of the things that I thought about as I watched from 3,000 miles away was, as a person that's from Charleston, South Carolina, and knowing a few of the people that passed away, even myself, because I'm from Charleston, living in LA, and hearing people talk about it, I was defensive. I was like, hold up, wait, you're not from, you don't know. Yeah, like, you
know, there were things people said that were just like, why would they let a white boy walk into church anyway and not be, well, if you knew, like,
this
white people walk in our church all the time. It's a historical landmark. We got College of Charleston right down the street, so kids come all the time. I, when they said it was a 21-year-old, I thought, a kid from the College of Charleston? Like, what in the world? Right. What, like, what were, I, just anything. And that wasn't the case, but that was, those were just the things going through my mind, because I know how we are and how we have had to operate and conduct ourselves, because you're, we were already on this, you know, locally, a historical landmark, and now is just like, oh my gosh. But that really was the thing for me that I, you know, I would tell my mom, I was get angry. Like, I'm not going anywhere. I don't want to go to this another thing. I don't yes. want to do it anymore. Like, we don't have to be a part of every single thing. And she would say, I understand.
Right.
But, you know, you have to, like, it was one of those, I get it. I know how you feel, but you have to understand that now, you know, it's almost like you end up having this responsibility. I heard it said when, I don't know, it was one of the recent occurrences, and it was like, well, what should the family come out and say? Like, Breonna Taylor, what should her, why do we expect them to come out and say anything? Why is it their responsibility to temper everybody else's feelings? And that's all, like, since then, that part of it, because, you know, we have come to have relationships with a lot of the families that have been impacted by violence, racial violence. And
you mean outside of Mother Emanuel?
Outside of Mother Emanuel. So, you know, like Walter Scott's family or George Floyd's family. So, you know, it's like, it's not their job to do that. Like, I don't feel like it's their job, but I get it. I really do get it, because there were times where I even thought, well, if somebody would just come out and say something, it would kind of, you know, bring the tension down or ease the tension, give a little bit of calm.
It doesn't, though.
It shouldn't be the expectation. Like, right. If they want to, then yeah, give them that space. If that's because people grieve differently. I do realize that. But it was a lot. And then, you know, we had the flag come down.
Yeah.
So, yay. We had the flag.
Like, yay. Yay. It's so funny. I just saw, Mother Emanuel was actually literally just on, you know, the Sunday morning, CBS Sunday morning. Yeah. Uh-huh. They did a whole bit on, the statues that are being pulled down in the recent years. They said over 100 statues have been pulled down since Mother Emanuel happened, and to see it highlighted. And it's weird to watch it, not to compare my feelings to yours, because I didn't have but it's weird to watch it, because it's like all of a sudden you're using this incident, that was not just an incident, but an impactful thing on human beings and human lives. And I get it. I really do. I get it.
Right.
But people tend to forget the humanity behind it, you know, and
you see both sides of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see both sides of it, because I mean, I was glad. I felt like it should have come down when, and I think I said this, as we were on the steps of the State House, I was like, it should have come down when people were marching from Charleston to Columbia years ago, trying to get it taken down. This should have happened then. It should not have, you know, cost us 9 lives
Knives.
For this to happen.
for something.
Yeah. I'm glad it's down, but it should not, that it shouldn't have taken this. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20. I get that. But, you know, and even now, and I think I shared this with you when we talked about having this interview, that normally I would defer to my mom to speak about anything dealing with or someone else from the family, but because it was you, I was I wanted to have the conversation because I think it's important. One of the things that I have in my working with the Memorial Foundation have stressed the need for changes in education, and I think that I remember having an experience after one of the days at the trial. I went every day of the first phase of the trial, and there was one day, it was in December, so afterwards my son had a program at his school, like a Christmas holiday program. And I'm sitting there looking at these young kids, elementary age kids, thinking, his mom probably sat at a program like this at some point and something went wrong. Like, I'm looking at all of the kids and I'm thinking, it could be one of them at some point. Years down the line, you don't know where somebody falls through the cracks. And I think because a big part of our lives we're spent in school, like when I think about growing up, it's mostly either the schoolhouse or the playground.
That's
those are the childhood places you remember being, or even as a high school adolescent, it's school or the playground or maybe even church. But the school is a predominant fixture in your life growing up. And there's so many people that have an opportunity to be the one to turn things around for you. And I remember, like, we always remember those teachers, either the teachers who didn't do what they should have, or those who went above and beyond and flipped the switch for us to say, I am going to be this person that I know I can be.
Right.
Or provide such, or open up opportunities for you to have such a bad experience that you revert to doing things that you know. I mean, and we all have a choice in that matter, but we are influenced by that. And so education is huge. I mean, I was a teacher. Most of my family, my Aunt Myra was an English teacher. So that's always been important to us. But we talk in the with the Memorial Foundation a lot about how we can help try to make some of those changes. I mean, you and I talked earlier about the lack of Black history being taught in schools and what an impact it would have had on us had it was.
It would have been.
Yeah, and really? Education is huge. That's huge. And I think that's where we really can make the most impact, especially on our children.
Absolutely.
And that's the group that I like to focus on, our children, because that moment sitting in that auditorium, watching those kids and thinking something happened with this child, because I still saw him as a child sitting in that courtroom. Something happened with him that a lot of people missed. Not making excuses, but something happened that was missed opportunity after missed opportunity. And I don't want to put all of that on educators or to sound like that's what I'm doing. But I also felt like somewhere down the line, he got some misinformation about Black people and who we are and what we want out of, you know, from this life. He got misinformation. And so
I think my thing is, you know, as kids, seeds, bad seeds and good seeds are planted in us. And along the way, those seeds are fertilized.
Oh, yeah.
Each one in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the way it works is if one seed gets fertilized, something else may not get it. So it's like the rain. It's like it rains one place, but it doesn't rain another place. That's how the weather works. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how it is. And so it's this idea of along the way, all these different seeds, you said it earlier, racism is taught. This hatred is taught and it's learned behavior. So we are, and this is how awesome God is, right? Because he creates us without that. When we're brought into the world, we're not brought into the world with any type of negative hatred. We are brought into the world feeling love for everyone.
That's innate. That's the thing that's innate.
So along the way, those seeds that were within him and all the others that have committed these heinous crimes, those seeds were not fed, fertilized.
The way that it should have. Right.
The way that they
something from outside was able to come in and take root. And that's why I feel like we have to figure out different ways. And I, like I said, I'm not placing this on just the education system. I think there's a lot that we can do to change and to restructure how that's being taught. Mm-hmm. But there are other ways that it can be taught as well.
Yeah.
There are other areas where, you know, other places that kids are where they can get that information and should get it.
So there is now an Emmanuel 9 Foundation. So I want you to talk about exactly what the Emmanuel 9 Foundation is and what its purpose and goals are.
Okay. So the Emmanuel 9 Memorial Foundation, we are in the process of raising funds to build a memorial on the grounds of the church, on the grounds of Mother Emmanuel, to do just that, to memorialize the loved ones that we lost, and just to have a space where people can come to reflect and to process, to think about, and just to soak in all that is a part of their legacy, the love, the honor, the spirit of hope, just to be able to have that, a place of solitude if you need that. And so we are, like I said, in the process of raising the funds to build the memorial. But on the other side of that, as the foundation, we are looking at ways to just encourage everyone to look at how racism has come to play in our communities and to think about different ways that we can begin to have the right conversations, meaningful conversations, ways that we can have that conversation in our households or with our friends and family, or just engage in other areas in our communities so that we begin to learn more about each other as a whole. And so that's been the broader goal of the Emmanuel 9 Memorial Foundation, because we recognize that each of those 9 lives, they were all impactful in various ways. Beginning with our pastor being a state senator and just fighting for our rights as South Carolinians. And we had my Aunt Myra was, like I said, she was a teacher, and just loved educating the youth in the community. the whole gamut. Cynthia Hurd with the running the library, and literacy was like passion for her. Yes, one of our classmates who's a librarian. Just it's just amazing the reaches that they all had. And I don't want to go down the line and
and forget anyone. Yeah, I understand. If you go to my website, if you go to emmanuel9.org, you'll see the list of names. If you go to my website, the post that I made, the names are listed there. We don't want to neglect the legacies or names of anybody.
But, you know, I mean, I could go through the list with
Miss Ethel,
River Sharonda, and, you know, she was also an educator, a counselor, and just phenomenal preacher. Like, you just, like.
See, I didn't know her.
Just amazing. Miss Lance, I mean, Miss Lance took care of us. Like, she took care of us. And that was, that. You know, you did not come in Mother Emmanuel without knowing who Miss Lance was, because she was taking care of everything. I mean, I think about Taiwan's. I remember Taiwan's growing up in the church. Like, you always feel like the bigger kid when you're in high school and they're in elementary school. So, I mean, and just that smile and all of the things that he did and accomplished in his lifetime. It's just amazing. I think about him and I know there's no excuse to not do anything that you have on your heart to do. It's just a huge loss. I mean, I think about Reverend Simmons and just how powerful he was, and knowing, you know, he had that military background. So he was a preacher, but you were going to stay in line with Reverend Simmons. But I mean, it's just those kinds of things that we kind of think back on and just remember about them. And we talk about, when we talk about education, Miss Susie Jackson.
Okay.
I remember her being my youth leader with YPD. Oh, and so you learned that you were important and you were going to learn out Black history. You were going to learn it. I mean, she had the calmest, sweetest, most subtle spirit, but she made sure you knew who you were and whose you were, like, first and foremost. So, I mean, there's just so much. And we are working to make sure that their legacies continue and that people learn more about them and just what they were, the goals they were working toward. It may have been quiet. It may have been in the background, or it may have been something that you knew about from watching the news. But in some way, they all had an impact on our community, and we don't want to let any of that die. So
tell us about the 17 on 7 17th.
17 on the 17th. So we are encouraging folks to consider donating $17 on the 17th. We just started this campaign last month, or in August. And you can donate, and the website is there, emmanuel9.org. But yes, we, in honor of the 9 lives that we lost on June 17th in 2015, we are just asking that you consider contributing to the Memorial Foundation, 17 on the 17th. You can give once if you want, or if every month on the 17th you find it in your heart to give, we would greatly appreciate it. And, you know, like Ruthina said, we are on the ground. There are things that, you know, we're still figuring this out, but we are committed and really, really focused on making sure that the legacy of those that we lost continue on, and that it stands for something in our community and the greater community. So please, please, please consider contributing 17th on the 17th. And we want to encourage people to just reconcile your hearts and the actions that you take, as you know, things get crazy and we've seen it over and over again. But to just let love set in, and I'm not saying you can't be angry, you can't be frustrated, but at the end of the day, love is the thing that will conquer all. And it definitely helps heal.
It does. It does. So they can contribute $17 on the 17th. And correct me if I'm wrong, let's say you can't contribute 17. I think it would be awesome if you contribute $9.
Whatever. No amount is too small. Right. If you want to give more, we would greatly appreciate that. But if you, whatever you can contribute is definitely will be used for good. And we appreciate it.
So this particular, while we're recording today, this particular podcast episode will be officially launched on the 17th of this month, on October 17th. And so if you are hearing this right now on the 17th, go to Emmanuel9.org right now, and you will see where you can make that contribution to this awesome, awesome legacy of nine people. It is something I promise I know myself will go towards making a difference. So check out that website and do that as well. But Jamila, thank you so much for sharing your story, first of all. So I would love to talk to you again, but thank you so much for sharing your story. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you for having me. And of course, I would talk to you anytime, anytime. We got 20, 25 years worth of stuff to talk about. So yes, anytime.
I know, right? I don't have time to put all of them up, but everyone's saying thank you for sharing. Thank you for sharing. You're welcome.
Thank you for being a part and listening.
So you guys, I want you to go to Emmanuel9.org, check out that website, look at all the wonderful work that they're doing in regards to the memorial, in regards to contributing to this awesome, awesome legacy. In the meantime, if you have any other questions, I know I do have a post up about my reaction to what happened there. You can go to RuthinaPorterfield.com and check it out there. Again, if you're listening to this on the 17th, go to Emmanuel9.org and contribute to the 17th on the 17th. I will actually put a link up so that you can click right on it, so there's no excuse. So in the meantime, I pray that this was a blessing to you and your heart and liberated your spirit in some way. Until our next conversation, peace, stay cool, and God bless.